Last week, six ministers resigned, and today five more declared a boycott of meetings. That leaves no active Sunnis in Prime Minister al-Maliki's cabinet. Leon Panetta was chief of staff to President Clinton, and he's a member of the Iraq Study Group. He says it's time to tell the prime minister time has run out.
Well, the feeling that we've had here is we've had a military surge, but we haven't really had, in conjunction with that, a diplomatic surge, a political surge to really put pressure on the Iraqis to accomplish the political reform that is essential. I mean, there were really three basic elements to the Iraqi study recommendations. One was that we have to make a transition from a combat role to a support role. Everybody has said that. The British Prime Minister said that the other day, and I think everyone believes that that's the transition we have to make. They have to implement the reforms, and frankly, we have to set a deadline for those reforms. Otherwise, they'll never happen. They'll continue to be dragged out. And our view of the Iraq Study Group was that if they continue not to implement these reforms, we have to take steps. There has to be a price to be paid. There can't be an open-ended commitment here. And lastly was the international effort to bring pressure on the neighboring countries, the Saudis, Jordan, Egypt, Iran, Syria, to try to bring pressure on the Iraqis to implement that political reform and to help stabilize the country. All of those steps are what is needed right now if we're going to have a clear strategy in Iraq.
Is it time for that price to be exacted? You said that the steps had to be taken if reforms weren't accomplished by certain deadlines. And if so, what price should be exacted now by the United States?
I think the first step is to present a very clear message to the Iraqis, which I don't think we have. Basically, the message we've sent them is that we'll continue to provide our military, we'll continue to provide our troops, we'll continue to carry the main burden in security, and the hope is that they will therefore have the breathing room to implement some political reforms. We have never sent a very clear message to the Iraqis that there is a deadline here with regards to their ability to accomplish these reforms. We are not simply going to continue to have an open-ended commitment there. So the first step has to be a very clear message to the Iraqis that time is up, that they have got to implement some of these reconciliation efforts. They've got to put them in place, and we've got to make very clear to them that unless they do that, that we are going to begin the process of withdrawing our economic, military, and diplomatic support.
Leon Panetta, formerly with the Clinton administration, now a member of the Iraq Study Group, or I should say, I guess it's continuing. Am I right in that? Does the Iraq Study Group still meet, or is it a past tense that I should use?
Well, I guess we still exchange phone calls, if that counts for anything.
Okay. All right. Let me introduce Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was also in the Clinton administration, ambassador to Croatia during the Clinton administration. And Mr. Ambassador, welcome to you.
Warren, very good to be with you again.
What do you say to what's happening now, the very pessimistic view we have heard from everybody about the ability of the Iraqis to put together political reform?
Well, I think we're being unfair to the Iraqis. The suggestion is that somehow they're lazy or they lack a will to do things. The reason they can't implement any of these so-called benchmarks is that they don't agree, and it's not that the leaders don't agree, it's that their constituents don't agree. The Kurds voted 98% for independence. Any change in the Constitution, which is one of the benchmarks, is going to subtract something from Kurdistan, and their voters who have to approve it will never accept that. The Shiites suffered horrifically under Saddam Hussein, including the top leaders who lost family members. De-Baathification is not just reemploying some ex-Baathists, it's reemploying people that they see as the mass murderers. Providing services to Sunni areas, which the Shiite government's been reluctant to do, they see it, and rightly see it, as basically providing services to the insurgents. So these are very tough things to agree about, but there's a second point, which even if they could implement all these benchmarks, it wouldn't make any difference. There's an American assumption that somehow this war is about sharing oil revenues or reemploying a few ex-Baathists and that kind of thing. It's not. It is that these three communities do not share a vision of Iraq. The Shiites believe that their majority entitles them to rule Iraq as a Shiite state. The Sunnis, even those who don't like Saddam, don't accept that the country that they feel they created is ruled by a group that excludes them. And the Kurdish vision of the future of Iraq is of a country that does not include them at all. They want out.
Again, Peter Galbraith, former ambassador to Croatia. Leon Panetta, back to you. What do you say to that? Essentially, forget the benchmarks because the Iraqis don't share a vision of what their country ought to look like.
Well, I'm not sure that that I would agree entirely with their vision. I mean, I think he's pointed out obviously the differences, the historical differences that make it very difficult. But when the Iraq Study Group sat down with all of the leaders there, plus the leaders in the neighboring countries, but particularly the leaders of these different factions, the Shia, the Sunni, the Kurd factions, all of them did not want to see that country divided up. I think all of them believe that Iraq should remain as one nation. And
but did they? What about their constituents, though? Ambassador Galbraith says that's the problem.
Well, I think, you know, I think the reality is that their leaders in many ways reflect the views of their constituents. Their constituents don't want an Iraq that's divided up. They want an Iraq that's unified under their particular sectarian control. I understand that. But, you know, what needs to be done here is that ultimately there have to be some compromises made. There has to be an effort to try to work through some of these reconciliation efforts in order to bring this country together. Now, you know, can that be done? That is the real test of whether or not Iraq survives. If they can't, if they in fact can't make the conciliation that is necessary, if they can implement some of the political reforms that are necessary, then I think Peter Galbraith is right, that ultimately what happens here, whether it happens by action or whether it's a de facto happening, it will result in the division of that country in which the Kurds go to their area and the Shiites go to their area and the Sunnis go to their area. But make no mistake about it, that kind of division isn't going to resolve the kind of conflict and violence that we're seeing now.
Thanks to our guest. I'm Warren Olney. We update America's longest war almost every day. We provide a variety of different perspectives so you can make up your own mind about Iraq and a multitude of other complicated events and issues. It's a unique service, and now it's your turn to make sure it continues. Telephone bills and a staff of energetic producers make for a big budget. So help us stay on the air with a pledge at 800-600-KCRW, 800-600-5279, or pledge online at kcrw.com. Robert Hormats has written a book called The Price of Liberty, Paying for America's Wars. He says President Bush is ignoring George Washington, who warned against passing the cost of war onto future generations. He also cites another general who became president, Dwight Eisenhower, who said, "The problem with defense spending is to figure how far you should go without destroying from within what you are trying to defend from without." Here's Robert Hormats.
He and, as you correctly point out, Washington and then Hamilton and Jefferson and many presidents before them were very careful during wartime to do several things. One, they all had to borrow money, but they made a point of paying down wartime debts as quickly as they could after the war. They also made a point of engaging the American people in the process of paying for the war, in part because they needed the money, but in part because they thought it was the patriotic duty of Americans to make some sacrifices at home while troops were making sacrifices on the battlefield. Wilson's Treasury Secretary, William Gibbs McAdoo, called it capitalizing patriotism. It was part of the effort to enable Americans to feel that they were part of the war effort at home to support their troops abroad. This could have been done after the 9/11 attacks. The president could have called for major cuts in non-security domestic spending. He could have done the same thing, for instance, after the beginning of the Iraq War, which, lest we forget, was relatively popular in 2003. Obviously, it's not anymore. But there were efforts that could have been made to engage the American people in supporting their troops, even with a little checkoff, for instance, to make sure that the American troops who were wounded were taken care of after the war, even $50 checkoff or $10 checkoff, just to engage Americans in the process. None of that occurred.
You say that there could have been cuts in non-security domestic spending. What about security domestic spending? I get the sense that one of your concerns is that so much money is going to the war in Iraq that we are failing to upgrade the infrastructure, as we have seen, of course, so tragically recently in Minnesota.
Yes, we've had a monodimensional view of American security, unfortunately, for a period of time. Obviously, you need to provide, as long as there are troops in the field, money for those troops to be well-armed and to get the equipment they need. That is imperative if the troops are fighting. But the other part of it is that we have a number of security needs at home. We need to, for instance, as we saw in the case of the tragic case of New Orleans, make sure that areas such as that are protected against these large hurricanes. We need to make sure, for instance, that our public health system is strong enough and robust enough to withstand a pandemic or, heaven forbid, some kind of terrorism with some kind of biotechnology, anthrax, anything of that nature, smallpox. Our public health system is not prepared for that kind of either naturally based or man-made kind of pandemic. And, of course, our infrastructure is crumbling. All these, in a way, are dimensions of national security. And you go back to Eisenhower. Eisenhower, during the height of the Cold War in 1956, introduced the National Interstate and Defense Highways Act that was done to build up American infrastructure. He saw that as part of a national security effort. That was one of the elements of his program.
Again, Robert Hormats, author of The Price of Liberty, also vice chair of Goldman Sachs. You have a sort of an anecdote about your own experience driving across the Brooklyn Bridge every day. Tell us how that illustrates your point about infrastructure as opposed, let us say, to some sort of terrorist incident.
Well, when you drive under the Brooklyn Bridge, there are actually nets there to prevent crumbling cement from falling on your car. The bridge, I think, itself has problems, but it just always a reminder that a lot of our infrastructure is old. I'm not sure this is threatened with collapse, but it just reminds you that why is there a net there? Because it's old and it's crumbling. And I think we have a massive job to do in this country. And it's not really whether you can pay for the war and pay for infrastructure. If need be, you can do both. And there's no guarantee that money that might not have been spent on the war would have been spent on domestic infrastructure. Part of the problem is the money. The other part is that the money is not allocated properly. Money tends to be allocated to programs that satisfy certain political constituencies. There's a lot of pork in this infrastructure program in this country, and very little of it goes to maintaining existing projects. A lot of it goes into new projects, which have the name of the political sponsor on them, but we need to spend a lot of time shoring up existing infrastructure. That's not as politically dramatic and doesn't get your name on new projects. So there's a lot of misallocation of the money that does exist, unfortunately, and has been appropriated.
We've only got a minute left, time for one more question, and I hope for the answer. You're a significant person. You're the vice chair of Goldman Sachs. You have been an advisor to presidents. Why do you think it is that President Bush has not engaged the country in the kind of conversation about war and sacrifice that you think is so necessary?
I honestly don't know why. I think that he clearly doesn't want to raise taxes, but there are other ways of encouraging sacrifice without raising taxes. There are, as I say, cuts in non-security, domestic spending, or reallocation of resources to programs that are needed. He could have done that. I mean, ironically, this is the first war of any major war when we haven't had a tax increase. We haven't had a cut in non-security spending. We financed this war almost entirely by supplementals, and foreigners have, in effect, paid for much of this by lending us the money. So Americans haven't been called on to make sacrifices, and I think that sets a bad precedent for the future, because we're going to have security needs and we're going to have infrastructure needs. We have to begin to set tough national priorities in these areas and many others to make sure that our fundamental needs are met. And unfortunately, we need a political dialogue with the American people to candidly tell them what's needed for our national security, both at home and abroad, and figure out how we're going to pay for it.
We will see if the presidential campaign upcoming provides that kind of dialogue. Robert Hormats, Vice Chair, Goldman Sachs, The Price of Liberty, Paying for America's Wars. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is my 15th year on KCRW, hosting Which Way LA, and now To the Point. But there's been so much to talk about with so many people, it seems a lot shorter than that. You've been wonderful to help us stay on the air with your contributions. Without them, we couldn't survive. So please call with a pledge or do it online at kcrw.com. With your help, we've got a lot of years left to go.